Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What legacy is left behind for the surviving loved ones of a suicide victim? And what does it take to come to terms with such complicated loss? My guest today was just 4 years old when her mother ended her life with a bottle of barbiturates. Her childhood was in many ways defined by the absence of a mother she could scarcely remember. Today, Dr. Nancy Rappaport is assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and works in clinical settings with troubled children and teens. But it was in part her children's questions, her own children's, about the grandmother they had never met that led her to probe her mother's life story. She shares that story in her memoir, out now in trade paperback. It's called In Her Wake, A Child Psychiatrist Explores the Mystery of Her Mother's Suicide. Nancy, welcome to Think.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
What's so interesting about the questions your children had when they were very little is that they sound a lot like the kinds of things that you would have wondered. Why did no one speak openly about your mother's death?
Well, that's such an astute question, because probably I have the benefit of being a child psychiatrist encouraging my kids to ask those unspeakable questions. But often, you know, when we have something very emotional happen in our lives, even as adults, it's very hard for us to have what some people refer to as crucial conversations, so that you skirt around the most salient question about where is my mother and why would she kill herself, because it's so painful for adults to find ways to answer those questions. So, you know, my kids and I find in working with children, they have inordinate curiosity and often don't hold back from questions, but sometimes, you know, as families, we can have unspoken rules about what's allowed to be talked about and what isn't. And as families members, we just sort of absorb those unspoken rules. And that was the exciting thing, to be an adult and to come back and to, with both my training as a child psychiatrist, my curiosity as a new mom and a daughter, to say, I want to dig a little deeper.
I was struck also by the question your children began to ask as they got a little older. They wanted to know whether you might someday do the same thing. And it turns out there is, in fact, a significant risk for immediate family members of those who die by suicide.
Well, I want to unpack some of the things. And mm-hmm. One thing is, I immediately reassured my kids when they would say, would you ever do anything, which is a natural question for a child to ask a parent who's had their own mother kill themselves, and
sure.
And I am confident that I wouldn't kill myself. And it's also, though, an opportunity when you have teenagers to do some mental health education around, you know, there may be mental illness in our family, these are the kinds of symptoms that might come up, and to really try to destigmatize the aspect of getting treatment if you happen to have a mental illness and become suicidal. The second part of what you said, though, is around the increased risk of suicide if you have a family member who has died by suicide. And although that's true, it's really important to contextualize that, because whereas the risk of you, me, anybody walking along the street of killing themselves is 8 in 100,000, if you're a child of a parent who's died by suicide, it's a 14 out of 100,000 people who will die. So it is two times as much, almost two to some. But I think when the media covers it, it can sometimes make it exaggerated and make it feel like it's a Russian roulette and it's a fait accompli. And I think we want to think about that statistic in a protective way. So that's part of why I've outreached to talk to family members of suicide or people who have been touched by someone who's died, to say, let's think of constructive ways that we can fortify ourselves so that we don't lose someone we love.
So, Nancy, in exploring your mom's life, you set out not only to understand her pain, but also to know who she was as a person at the times when she was mentally healthy. Can you talk a little bit about people who knew her and loved her, how they described her?
Yes, I'm the youngest of six children. The context of my mother's suicide, it was in 1963. I'm now 51 years old, and I was the youngest of six children, and it was in the context of a custody battle, but that was the tip of the iceberg. And I, growing up, never had a picture of my mother, and my dad did talk about him, and certainly she was a fairly, both my dad and mother were fairly prominent in Boston politics, and were in the newspaper a lot during custody battles. So I had read these sort of sordid newspaper articles, because at that point, suicide was covered in a very different way, and the custody battle was covered in detail. But I hadn't talked to people who knew and loved my mother, and that was one of the aspects that was incredibly healing for me. Because when you lose a parent to suicide, and probably what prompted me to write the book was me also trying to define myself as a mother, I had a void, and I needed to have more context for who she was. And people talked about, you know, and again, when someone dies by suicide, sometimes their life can be defined by the end and how they ended it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so rich to be able to hear how people would talk about her incredible devotion to us as children, how she had tried to elevate a basement to make a basketball court in the new home that she was renovating before she died. And she just had enraptured with Christmas and would, you know, wrap up all sorts of individual socks as presents for people. Those kind of small details. And the other aspect that was tremendously fortunate for me, and I've heard from some people who have either had a parent who's disappeared for all sorts of reasons, that sometimes it can be inordinately frustrating when you start digging. But I was fortunate enough that my mother's best friend had kept a trunk at the time after my mother had died, and had actually kept it for 35 years. So at the time I was writing the book, I was writing in the darkness and asking my mother, where are you? Who are you? How could you abandon me at this time when I'm trying to be a new mom? And then about 5 years into this kind of journal writing, I got her trunk. And in that trunk was a novel that she was writing at the time of her death called The End of Freedom, which is an ominous title. But it gave me an opportunity, if we do believe that oftentimes writing is an extension of ourselves, to have a window into who she was. So quite a journey.
Do you remember what was in your mind and in your heart when you took that unpublished manuscript and opened it for the first time, not knowing what you might find?
An enormous trepidation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now I talk about this and it all sounds like a linear narrative, but each time I would reach out to someone to try to uncover an understanding of her, you don't know what you're going to find out. And you don't know if you're going to like the person that you are trying to get to know. So, you know, when I opened it up, I was curious, you know, as a psychiatrist, but I didn't want to make her into sort of a case history, but I knew that this was a rich resource for insight into her. I felt ominous because it was titled The End of Freedom, and it gave me a sense that, you know, she had made a suicide attempt 2 years before, which places you at risk for a completed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And she came across as a, and she, I talk about it, it was a semi-autobiographical novel. The main character had four children, we had six, was running for governor, my mother was running for school committee. So there were definitely shifts, and I can't say it was a direct correlation. But the, you know, sometimes when you lose someone to suicide, you can also idealize them. And there were aspects of the novel where I was really, quite frankly, irritated with the writer. And I thought, she just doesn't get it. Like, she, the author has, you know, she's my mother. It's kind of confusing to people listening at this point. But the author was describing having a wake after the completed suicide of the main character. And the son is sitting around sprucing the flowers. And I think, you know, this person doesn't get the impact. And that's also been one of my drives, because I think when people are suicidal, they're in so much pain, they don't recognize how corrosive that can be to other people. And they have a false, what Tom Joyner talks about, a false perceived sense of burden. Hmm. So they don't have the opportunity to know the paralysis that can happen to a family and the enormous effort it takes to heal. And they think, you know, nobody might is going to miss me if I'm gone. And that's a profound mistake.
Yeah, there is that, you know, that warning sign of people thinking, well, I'll the world will be all right if I'm not within it, and the people who care about me will be fine. And in fact, in writing this novel, your mother's main character reflects on how her kids really don't need her very much anymore, and that's good that they're sort of moving out into the world. And yet the characters of the children at the time are very young. They're like 8 and 10 and around that age.
Yeah. So that was not right. Mm-hmm. If I could have reached across time to let her know, I would have.
Another thing that you write about, Nancy, that's really interesting, you stress not only as a human being, but certainly as a psychiatric professional, that everyone grieves in their own way. And yet it sounds like it's been a source of some tension within your family, that your siblings have all taken sort of different ways of looking at this. And it sounds like all of them are different from the way that this has affected you.
You know, it's now come out in paperback, so it's been out for 2 years. Mm-hmm. So if you'd asked me, you know, 4 years ago in the midst of it, I would have said there was more tension and more effort to try to agree to disagree. Mm-hmm. I always love that saying. and, you know, certainly my dad, you know, was much more an adult during that time and of the divorce, and it was a difficult time for him and for me to revisit it as 45 years later, he's now in his mid-80s, was something very generous for him and painful for him. And I'm sure he would have chosen for me to write it for a cathartic reason, but not to publish it. And I'm very appreciative and recognize that many family members, when someone chooses to write a memoir, may feel a certain amount of exposure. And that's, you know, some people make all sorts of choices, maybe not to publish it until after someone dies. You know, that wasn't something that seemed like my father wanted me to do. And then with my siblings, they, you know, different ones, I actually became closer to some of my siblings. Hmm. My older sister is somewhat of a perfectionist and wonderful, but very different from me. I'm sort of rough around the edges. And in the process of, you know, both reading this novel that my mother had written, my older sister had been involved in politics, and that was something that we could think about together, about what did it mean for my mother to be divorced in 1963 and have her political career basically come to a halt. And I had varying kind of different experiences. And what you say about with grief, sometimes I think people can get, I don't want to be insulting, but sort of feel like they have there's a hierarchy of grief. Mm-hmm. And so if you are the one who goes and pores over the documents of your mother and goes off and does interviews, that somehow that might make you a more resolved person than someone who decides to go for a hike. And I think there's room for both ways, any way that isn't self-destructive.
My guest is Dr. Nancy Rappaport. She's assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Her memoir, out now in trade paperback, is called In Her Wake, A Child Psychiatrist Explores the Mystery of Her Mother's Suicide. We'll take your calls now. You can get to us by phone at 1-800-933-5372. Of course, you can also send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Nancy Rappaport. She's assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and author of the memoir In Her Wake, A Child Psychiatrist Explores the Mystery of Her Mother's Suicide. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. By the way, we do want to mention that on the Think page, there is a link to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. If you feel like you're in trouble and need to talk, we would encourage you to pick up that phone and call 1-800-273-TALK. Nancy, did you, as a child, perhaps even as an adult, envy the fact that your older siblings had memories of your mom when you had to piece together something that was sort of a clouded sense from photographs and from other people's stories, but you didn't have that for yourself?
You know, I've never thought of it as envy. It was more wistful.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly even now sometimes when I see, you know, older mothers having... Now my daughter's 21. I have three kids and my oldest is 21, and I'm starting to have an adult relationship. But whenever I see an older woman in the airport with their daughter, I sometimes feel wistful. Mm-hmm. So there is, you know, it's much less now, but there's often a quality of wishing I had had more time.
How did it affect your relationship with your dad that he, in many ways, correctly, didn't blame himself for your mother having taken her own life? Did that make you angry in an emotional sense, even if you knew intellectually that, perhaps he was, of course, not responsible?
That's very sensibly asked. You know, in any family, there's often a tendency to have a blame game because, especially if you have, you know, I was 4 years old, and that's a time of magical thinking when you believe that if an airplane flies across the sky that you somehow made it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe that was partly why I had such a compelling need to understand that the complexity of it. But I have a story that I wrote in fourth grade that I'd kept with me, you know, for a lot of years, and I took it out as I was writing this memoir, and in it was a snapshot of my unconscious. And certainly in my unconscious I had... And this is frequent with kids who have experienced a suicide when they're young, is they get confused about suicide and murder.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for murder to happen, someone else has to do it. And that was probably one of my important aspects, was to be able to put to rest the idea that this was a tragedy, and that to go in the avenue of trying to assert blame, even though there were difficult circumstances, really wasn't the path to healing. And I think that's an aspect for all of us as we become adults, is we become much more compassionate, both, you know, for my mother and my father, in recognizing that we all do the best we can. And, you know, my father stood by us for a lot of years, and that was important.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that may have contributed to your mother's depression. For one thing, she had a really difficult relationship with her own parents. Mm-hmm. That started, it sounds like, around the time of her younger sister's accidental death.
Yes, so there was and that's often what we say about with suicide, it's the tip of the iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
So as I unpeeled the layers, I knew my mother's sister had died when my mother was about 8, and it turns out that my mother's sister had drowned when, and that her mother, my grandmother, had been away, and it also was that my grandmother was an alcoholic, and that was difficult for my mother, and I wondered. And this isn't me being a psychiatrist, it's really me just knowing that they're unanswered mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
If part of the difficulty with, you know, losing custody of her kids for my mother was that she had already experienced one, you know, very intimate loss as a young child, and it was difficult to tolerate. And you know, the other aspect is there was a question of whether she might have had postpartum depression, and that was not being recognized, and you know, that she struggled with her own, you know, mood swings, my mother, and you know, that that there was sort of a perfect storm that set her in a motion, which, you know, of course, now I'm very invested in helping keep people alive and get them through what may seem like a permanent problem, but actually is a temporary crisis.
I think most people listening understand that severe depression puts people at risk for suicide, but you also point to the fact that a tendency toward impulsivity is a major risk factor when combined with that depression. Can you talk about how that seems to have manifested itself in your mother's life, just based on what you were able to learn about her through what you read?
You know, impulsivity is partly, again, not to try to over-intellectualize before I dive into my mother, but, you know, if you think, the stunning statistic I always think is that 1% of suicide attempts are by guns, but they're 50% of completed suicides. Hmm. So that puts into context that there are some people who are very determined about killing themselves, but there are many people who will have a temporary crisis and come to the other side. In fact, you know, 80% of people who show up in a psychiatric emergency room won't go on and have made a serious suicide attempt, won't go on to kill themselves. Of course, there's the concerning other percentage that will. But the impulsivity part, you know, can come from making a flash decision and not thinking about the repercussions. And that's why also with suicide, the risk with substance abuse is, you know, if you put impulsivity and drug or substance abuse, or alcohol abuse, that's a really toxic combination.
Yeah.
So in my mother's situation, you know, there were, and again, I'm doing this as a detective, and I have to be humble about it. I'm trying to build a narrative, and I could be, you know, if she was alive now, she could correct me, but she's not, so she can't. But there seemed to have been aspects of her decision-making that were very impulsive. She left my father and went with her campaign manager. So, and he had three children. He was 10 years younger than her. So he was 23. She was 30, you know, 31-ish at the time. And that's sort of, that, to me, if you have six kids, that's an impulsive decision. So there were aspects which, and not to overinterpret a novel, but the main character also seemed to have these quick, not always well-thought ideas.
Let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We'll speak first with John in Fort Worth. Hi, John.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I lost a very close friend and colleague almost 2 years ago, suicide. And I was probably closer to him, just a little backstory that maybe answered my question better. And spoke to him every day, which I don't think anybody else in his life actually did. And already gotten past the whole, I could have done this or I should have seen this process. But there was something that's always bothered me. That the day before he actually committed suicide, we had met up. And I hadn't seen him that happy in I don't know how long. He was excited about going to some things that he liked to do over the weekend. And was just, I mean, just almost elated. I mean, it made me feel better that he was in a good mood. But I didn't realize. Since then, I've heard people say things like once somebody's made up their mind to take their own life, that there's almost that sense of relief before they do it, things like that. And I was just wondering if there was any clinical fact to that.
Yes.
And I'll take it off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Well, John, first of all, it sounds like you were a tremendous friend to him, calling him every day, and that there is clinical information. Tom Joyner talks about it, too. To support the idea that sometimes there is what you're talking about and where clinically sometimes people will feel reassured because someone has future plans and then they'll feel doubly deceived, like they'll be confused. How could you pay the rent for the next month and kill yourself after that? And in my mind, it makes sense to me because the idea of suicide, you have confused logic. So you're not able to tolerate the ambiguity in life. So you might make decisions that aren't consistent with logic. And you know, that's because I'm sure looking from the outside, you would look at your friend and say there were many important, valuable aspects that he could contribute, and yet he couldn't see that. So the part I always think is so important is to never be afraid of checking in with someone. So if they seem elated, and yet it seems like a pretty dramatic change from the severe depression that they may have had, or the sense that you've been being very supportive, is to never be afraid to ask the question, you know, I'm a little confused. You seem so happy. You know, are you still thinking about suicide? And not to feel like you're insulting someone by asking that question, because oftentimes that can be a life-saving question.
Yeah, what do you say to people who are worried about a friend or a family member? There's always this sense that we don't want to pry, even in the lives of people we might be very close to. Where do you get that courage to actually say to someone, I'm concerned about you?
Well, there's a wonderful website called www.qpr, so people could read more about that. Mm-hmm. But the most important thing is to take a deep breath and to maybe, you know, practice saying it in the mirror before if it feels frightening to say. But then if a question is asked with care and compassion, you know, that's all you can ask from yourself. So to be able to say I'm really concerned, and to speak factually about the things that you've seen that may concern you, that, you know, you're drinking more, or that you seem to be in a bad mood all the time, you're giving away things, don't seem to be sleeping a lot, talk about having no reason for living, and I want to know, are you thinking about killing yourself? And, you know, that, and then once, if someone acknowledges that, it's to be very measured in making sure that they know that they're not alone, that you want them to get help with sorting this out, and you want them to stay alive.
Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing the right thing to say is never, but you have so much going for you.
The problem with that response, although I certainly feel that every time I sit with a teenager, and, you know, I love working with teenagers, is that's at the point when someone is thinking about they'd be better off dead, their sense of value of who they are is so, sometimes can be so small, mm-hmm. that it can feel as if they're not being understood. So I think, again, every situation is different, but I think a response of more, you know, I would miss you so much, and, you know, there's so many things that I value about you. I love to have whatever it is, you know, mm-hmm. can maybe feel like they don't have to discount what you're saying. You're just trying to make me feel better. You don't understand.
Yeah.
You know.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Kenny on the line in Southeast Texas. Hi, Kenny.
Yes.
Hi, Kenny. Go ahead, please.
I was just curious. I lost my mother. I don't know when it was. I've got some amnesia issues. I was attacked 3 years ago. So I don't remember when she died. She called out for me in the hospital room, for me specifically, but it's a story that I heard, and I've had a hard time kind of dealing with that since then. I've actually attempted to commit suicide just right at the moment my wife left, because she couldn't handle what I was going through with a close brain injury and stuff. But the only reason I'm here today is because the shotgun didn't fall off, the pin broke in the gun.
Excuse me for interrupting, Kenny. Are you doing okay today? You don't feel like you want to end your life now?
No, I mean, I just feel like for what happened, there must have been some reason that I'm supposed to be here, but I'm still wondering, you know, why. I'm not sure really why I am here. I got back together with my wife, but it's not working out.
Well, Kenny, I'm glad you're still alive to try to figure out what your higher purpose is. But the other aspect that I would say is that what you're talking about is often true, which is that particularly for men, when they face a loss of their spouse, that they can be more at risk for suicide, because they feel devastated by trying to figure out how do they go on after that. And it also sounds compounded with that is that you have closed brain injuries, which makes it hard for you to remember things, and you know that those combinations. And I certainly hope that in the context of this enormous pressure that you have, and again, I don't know about with Texas because I know people like their guns, but that you know you don't have a gun around, so that those times when you do feel desolate and alone, that you have to, that you can reach out for support and not have a means to carry it out. And you know, that's something so important, to find the time to build strength.
And Nancy, the phone number that we mentioned earlier for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 1-800-273-TALK, people can call that even if they don't feel they are in imminent danger. Is that correct?
Yes.
They
can call to get support because they want to avert a crisis.
Mm-hmm. Talk about this. I mean, you're very generous in telling your story, both in writing the book and in doing this interview, and I know you've done countless others. Does it get any easier for you to take yourself through these memories after time?
You know, just like with talking to Kenny, the mission I've had to reach out to people is to really let people know that we want you to stay alive, and that these setbacks are temporary. So that's what gives me the momentum and the drive, with it being there. I won't say that telling the story, I have to find inner strength each time. It's not a robot, and the day it becomes a robot, robotic information would be the time I'd stop doing interviews.
Yeah. My guest is Dr. Nancy Rappaport. She's assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and author of the memoir In Her Wake, A Child Psychiatrist Explores the Mystery of Her Mother's Suicide. You can join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Nancy Rappaport. Her memoir is called In Her Wake, A Child Psychiatrist Explores the Mystery of Her Mother's Suicide. We have an email here from Steve who writes, "My father took his life when I was 10. It's interesting to me that while I feel I was old enough to incorporate the loss, there is still a child in me that will never understand." Is it something that you can relate to?
Yes, there's a wonderful article called The Telling and the Knowing. And, you know, what happens is that at seminal times of your life during transitions, you may revisit the loss of a parent. So maybe at a high school graduation, a birth, a death of someone you love. And that there's a gap sometimes between the sort of visceral responses that you might have about losing a parent, and that can stay with you for a long time.
I would imagine also for children who experience this, and maybe for a lot of adults, there's that emotional sense that if this person had loved me enough, he or she would have stuck around, which is, it's not about not loving someone when a person takes his or her own life, but there's still that thing to be grappled with.
I don't think it's just with that kind of loss. I think I've seen it with children who've been adopted, that they'll wonder if someone loved me, and that they must be somehow inherently damaged for them to be given away, which of course we know is a fallacy. And that's the work that has to be done in healing, is to recognize, you know, and that's when he's talking about there's a gap, because intellectually I know that having worked with many parents, that probably my mother was not thinking about the welfare of her children at the time that she killed herself.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, that's an intellectual stance. And but, you know, my growing confidence, it's taken me a while, but comes from me, you know, recognizing the value of who I am. But that struggle is certainly salient.
Did you understand fully as a younger adult, Nancy, before you undertook this project, that you hadn't fully coped with your mother's death?
Again, I think it's that I went through periods of time when I did therapy. It's probably why I ended up being a child's guide, because mm-hmm. I've been well therapized. You know, when I was in high school, when I was in seventh grade, I did this brilliant move, decided to run away from home and decided to stay at the school, which wasn't the most brightest idea. But after that point, my best friend's mother recommended that I get therapy. And so I'd go across the street and go to therapy. And that was a very important piece of work that I did in terms of feeling less of the guilt that somehow I was damaged or I had done something wrong. And that was very important. I think the next time that I went back into therapy was when I was becoming a psychiatrist and had had my own children. And then I wasn't so much trying to understand the suicide in the context of being a daughter, but in the context of being a mother. So there are various times that you might roll up your sleeves and think, okay, I need to revisit this.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm done.
Yeah.
This memoir is my gift to anybody else.
Talk about working with teenagers who are in trouble. I mean, they can be tough to talk to even when they're not in existential pain. When someone comes to your office and they don't even want to talk to you necessarily, but you know they're in trouble, how do you begin to forge a relationship with them to help them heal?
Well, you know, I'm always worried because if I say that I have a reputation for working with tough teenagers, the next kid that walks in is going to definitely deck me. I'm never going to make a relationship with them. And, you know, the important aspect is, first of all, most of us give everybody a chance to connect with us. It's like the 20-second rule is what I tell training doctors.
Mm-hmm.
So that you have to be humble, be present, be yourself when you're working with teenagers who are pissed off, and not be afraid of the fact that they may be dismissive of you or you know, just angry, and that you just kind of weather the storm, and then you try to find a place that is where you both can sort of step outside of what's going on and try to say, is there any way that I can make this easier for you? And maybe you won't. I mean, sometimes you'll get... I always give the option when I talk with a patient, which is if they meet me and they really, really don't like me, that they can fire me.
Mm-hmm.
And that acknowledgement that this is a choice about being in a relationship is really important.
How do you form relationships with their parents? Because I know there's confidentiality issues, and you really need that young person to trust you. And I'm sure mom and dad, who are, you know, scared out of their wits, want to know everything that went on in that room.
So one of the trickier parts about being an early therapist, and certainly you could say it even about me and why it's so important to be self-reflective, is that you want to be aware of the different pulls that happen. So if you, say, went into child psychiatry because you feel like you want to champion kids who've been wronged, that's dangerous, because you have to make a double alignment. You have to be connected to the teenager enough that they're going to talk with you, but also connected enough with the parents that they're reassured that if they're that they can trust your judgment on a need-to-know basis. So I always, you know, and all therapists do this, tell teenagers, if you want to kill someone else or you want to kill yourself, confidentiality is off.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are those gray areas. Maybe they're telling you that they are drinking and they blacked out at a party 2 weeks ago. Do you tell the parents, or do you work on helping the teenager be reflective about harm reduction and the dangers of getting in a car? Or is there a certain point where you give them a choice, either I'll tell your parents or you and I can tell your parents, but this is something I really think your parents need to know.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to navigate in a sort of delicate, respectful way that both honors the teenager's autonomy and recognizes that parents are scared and that you want to share the responsibility, because I know I have three kids myself, and I would be devastated if there was really high-risk behavior happening and a therapist withheld that from me and didn't allow me to monitor more closely or give me some tips about how I could strengthen my relationship so that the child could share some of what was going on.
Obviously, you are a professional and you've worked, you know, for years on building your abilities. You write very movingly, though, about observing a play therapy session with a four-year-old who had lost a parent to suicide. And you're concerned that going in to even observe that might hit too close to home. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It did hit too close to home because, I mean, I was in my first year of child psychiatry training, and this was the first, way that we were learning about how to, see one, do one.
Yeah.
And that was inordinately painful to see that. And even now, as I've gone around the country talking with families who've lost someone to suicide, that it's never something I take cavalierly. And sometimes it's a soccer punch when you see someone in so much anguish. Now, usually they've had less time than me to kind of metabolize it. Again, I've had 45 years. That's probably why I can do this kind of public, offering.
Mm-hmm.
But, when you are in a community, and I do this because I do school consultation, who's just lost a teenager to suicide, it is heart-wrenching. Mm-hmm. And you have to do self-care because it's brutal.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Candace on the line in Flower Mound. Hi, Candace.
Hi. I was just wondering, I've always been a person who kind of struggled with having suicidal tendencies, and I don't now by any means, but what I found is, for myself, I've never actually been able to get rid of the thoughts of suicide, but instead my reaction to them are different. Now I go to my doctor and get new medicine, or I call a friend or whatever, and I was just curious if that was a typical kind of recovery from it, if that makes sense.
Yes, no, first of all, I'm so happy you have extra support to deal with those thoughts. And sometimes, what you might be highlighting is that oftentimes with suicidal thoughts, in 90% of people, it may be because they have a major psychiatric illness that might not be treated optimally, so that if you started to have more intrusive thoughts about killing yourself or harming yourself, that you go back to the doctor to say, this is happening, and can we make some changes? So, because maybe the medication isn't the right medication, we know, and that's a really important safeguard, and that also recognizing that sometimes in stressful times you might need to reach out. And that's definitely something that I work on with my patients, because sometimes when people are really depressed, what they do is isolate themselves. And it's the opposite thing that we want to encourage people to do, which is to reach out and allow people to give the kind of support that you deserve. So, no, I think you're right on target about your approach.
Let's go back to the phones. Once more, we have Shannon on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Shannon.
Hi. I have a question for you. About 12 years ago, my husband tried to commit suicide, and he has visual scarring from it. And we now have teenagers. And they have asked questions over the years about what happened, and when they were younger, one actually even asked if he'd been attacked by a shark. And, right now it was a car accident. Mm-hmm. We're very unsure how to talk to them, when to talk to them, or even if to talk to mm-hmm. them about it, because it's such a heavy subject, and I just need a little bit of guidance on it.
Thank you, Shannon, for having the courage to call up about this. You know, that's partly what I was talking about with these kind of crucial conversations. You know, one of the concerns I would have if you didn't talk about them with it, and every family makes their own decision, but it would be that maybe you would lose control of how your teenagers found out about it. So there might be a relative of, or a niece or a nephew that hears about it and decides in some moment to talk about that. It reminds me of the Our Town Ben Affleck's movie where someone meanly reveals that Ben Affleck, you know, the character of Ben Affleck's mother killed herself. And I, as a parent, would much rather be able to script what we wanted to say than have it come from someone and then have the kids feel like you betrayed us or you lied to us. And to me, it's an incredible modeling of being able to say, especially to teenagers, that there are things that happen that are hard to talk about, but we want to talk to you about it because we want to be open and honest with you, and we had trouble finding the words. Mm. So what I would think about saying is, you know, at a time that's not emotional in terms of, like, after a big fight or something, but just to be able to say, you know, we're heading into a time where we didn't quite know the words to talk with you about it or the right way to say it, but we have something we want to talk to you about. You know, and then, as we talked at the beginning of the show, first of all, really reassuring them that, you know, whatever troubles were going on, that your father is planning on staying alive, mm-hmm. and that, you know, being connected to his sons or daughters is so important to him. But there was a time when he was depressed or whatever was going on, substance abusing, or, you know, I don't want to speculate, and that he thought that this was something that would make his, you know, that this was an option, which clearly isn't what he wants to do now. And then if there's a family history of either substance abuse or mental illness, it's an incredible opportunity also to educate them about that and to say, if there's a time when you start to feel so bad that you want to kill yourself, we want to know about it. And if there's, you know, and in our family we may have X, whatever it is, you know, and then describe those symptoms so they can recognize it and say, you know, we would want to work with you to get help.
Nancy Rappaport, Dr. Nancy Rappaport, is assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Her memoir is out now in trade paperback. It's called In Her Wake, A Child Psychiatrist Explores the Mystery of Her Mother's Suicide. Nancy, it's been a really interesting hour. I so appreciate you being with us.
I'm honored that you allowed me to be with you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.